From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. The Fiji government has used its numbers in Parliament to suspend a third opposition MP, saying one of his speeches in the House that was racist and inflammatory. The suspension gave rise to heated sparring in the legislature, including the comparison of Hitler's hostility towards Jews. Sally Round followed the debate.
Sedelpa's Ratui Soetikothau was found to have breached parliamentary rules around freedom of speech by listing Muslim officials serving in high office in the government of Frank Bainimarama. There's been heightened sensitivity around the issue since Mr. Bainimarama's military coup in 2006, followed by his election to power in 2014 with long-time running mate Ayaz Sayed Kayyum. Mr. Bainimarama warned Ratu Isoa's words are how hatred is sown, as with Hitler's campaign against Jews.
Tomorrow, when it suits aggressors, it could be North Indians and South Indians and Gujaratis. It could be the Chinese. It could be the Catholics.
Mr. Bainimarama said the speech was the worst breach of parliamentary rules yet.
We have to be vigilant in punishing any form of discrimination and jealously guard against any efforts to promote such hatred.
Ratu Isoa's suspension until the end of the term follows that of Tupou Tranidalo of another opposition party, the NFP. She's also out for the 2 years remaining until the next election after calling a government MP a fool. And last year, Ratu Nangama Lalambalavu got 2 years suspension for allegedly using an offensive word against the speaker at a meeting outside Parliament. Opposition MPs said the latest suspension was also harsh and unreasonable and wanted the suspension reduced to 30 days.
This is a tyranny of majority on the other side. You've sent two members out of parliament. You've been told by the IPU that it was wrong, that it was unreasonable. Yet, you want to go again and suspend another member.
The leader of the NFP, Biman Prasad, was referring to an international parliamentary body, the Inter-Parliamentary Union, which had warned Fiji over one of the previous suspensions.
This motion by this government, they could be accused of inciting religious hatred. They're heightening this tension and hoping that somehow the Muslim community will vote for them in 2018. They won't. Many of them out there understand what is the real issue.
Before leaving the parliament, Ratu Isoa apologised, but said he wasn't a racist and was only addressing the bubbling concerns of the people he represents.
You know that I did not address any religion, nor do I address any race. It is purely a concern of a guy, a peacekeeper, who had gone around all the world to fight only with one thing, peace and no instability.
Ratu Isoa is not allowed near the parliamentary precinct, including opposition offices, for the remainder of the parliamentary term. This is Sally Round.
Lawsuits are set to be slapped on the Catholic Church in Guam after legislation was passed allowing child sexual abuse survivors to sue them at any time. A lawyer representing 9 victims accusing clergy members of abuse says he intends to file lawsuits as soon as next week. Joe O'Brien has the story.
Lawyer David Lujan says his clients are overwhelmed by the passing of the bill, which removes the statute of limitations for lawsuits against child sex abusers and their institutions.
Everyone's elated and everyone is really grateful to the legislature and to the governor. The governor sent a beautiful message as to why he signed it into law.
The new law comes after Guam's Archbishop Anthony Aperon has been accused of molesting or raping at least 5 altar boys in the 1960s and 70s, and other clergy members have also been accused of historical abuse. David Lujan says 5 of his clients have made allegations against the Archbishop, while 4 are accusing other church members. He says they all intend to sue the alleged perpetrators and the Catholic Church.
Let's face it, a lot of these priests that abused the victims, most of them took a vow of poverty, and so they don't have any assets. The only potential assets will be an insurance policy, and then, of course, the other deep pocket is the church.
In his message, Governor Eddie Calvo admitted he'd been conflicted about the bill, but said it would open the doors of justice to those who suffered a terrible harm as children. Earlier, the Catholic Church had delivered a petition urging him to block the bill as it would leave it bankrupt and put church services at risk. But after it was signed, Archbishop Savio Hontai Whai, who has temporarily replaced Archbishop Aperon, issued a statement expressing thanks to the governor and others involved in the legislation.
We acknowledge the agony suffered by victims of child sexual abuse by clergy and the responsibility the Archdiocese has to bear. The Archdiocese is developing a dedicated fund as one way to help persons who've been gravely hurt in this way by the clergy.
The church is also reaching out to victims by encouraging people with knowledge of sexual abuse by clergy members to contact its abuse response coordinator. But victims advocate Joelle Castex from the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests questions its motives.
Now that the law has been passed, I highly suggest that survivors think very long and hard before calling the church, because the church is going to do everything they can to protect their legal interests. Right now what they're doing are just band-aid measures to try to make themselves look better in the eyes of what is going to be upcoming some very ugly times.
Joelle Castex says she expects the church to throw a lot of money into fighting abuse cases and is advising victims to consult their lawyers. Senator Frank F. Blass Jr., who introduced the bill to the Guam legislature, says it has given victims an avenue to seek justice when they're ready.
Children in their young years are very impressionable. You know, the fear that was imposed on them for many years, when they do have the time and, you know, when they feel that it's right, this is what this law now provides them, to seek the justice and the closure that they truly deserve and they need.
Governor Eddie Calvo has questioned the constitutionality of the legislation, which allows lawsuits to be filed retrospectively at any time. But Senator Blass says he's confident it will stand up to any legal challenge. Lawyer David Lewin says he expects more victims of abuse by clergy members to come forward following the introduction of the new law. This is Joe O'Brien.
The Vanuatu opposition is calling on Australia and New Zealand to offer Vanuatu passport holders visa-free access. This follows New Caledonia and French Polynesia granting visa-free entry. While most of the Pacific, including Vanuatu, has been given the same access to the European Union. In a statement, the opposition has expressed its gratitude to France and called on New Zealand and Australia to follow suit. It says if Australia and New Zealand want closer economic relations, they need to open their borders to grant visa exemptions to Vanuatu citizens. The head of the Institute for Pacific Research at Auckland University, Danan Salasa, says much of the Pacific has been pushing for easier access to the two metropolitan countries for years. Don Wiseman asked him why Australia and New Zealand are opposed.
Well, I think on the Australia and New Zealand side, they kind of recognise seasonal employment schemes are the way that they're dealing with it in a political sense. But what we've discovered in the process of all the negotiations around PACER Plus is that what is preferable to the Pacific nations would be genuine labour mobility, so the rights of access and residency. And so I think something that's come up time and again in PACER Plus, and it's particularly obvious in Australia, you know, New Zealand has very large settled Pacific populations, but Australia's one is very small, and what there is in Australia has actually mostly come through New Zealand by right of New Zealand citizenship and access to Australia.
But over and above the labour mobility provisions that they're talking about in association with PACER Plus, shouldn't this just be a general offering by Australia and New Zealand to these countries? If it's good enough for the European Union, surely it's good enough for New Zealand, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, many of the fears that might be entertained locally in Australia and New Zealand, we can see from places like the Cook Islands, where there hasn't been a wholesale emptying of populations into New Zealand. So I do think it's certainly feasible that you could open that access. I think the problem in Australia and New Zealand is more a political problem around questions of migration. But I think there's no real political will in Australia and New Zealand to reopen access for Pacific Islanders. In New Zealand, for instance, it's rather than becoming easier for Pacific people to migrate to New Zealand, it's become substantially harder since the 1990s.
Yes. How big an issue is it for Pacifica peoples?
Well, I think it's enormous, and we probably need to really reimagine how we understand these societies and economies because, you know, for instance, a country like Tonga gets 40% of its GDP from remittances. And so, you know, the out-migration of workers is the substantial driver of domestic development. Whereas in the past, we've seen it as a loss to Tonga. I think increasingly we're able to imagine it as a benefit. And, you know, for instance, in New Zealand, during the peak of the RSE season, there's close to 2,000 Tongans working in New Zealand who live in Tonga. So that's 2% of Tonga's population and probably something like 10% of its working population actually working offshore and then returning to Tonga. So I think there's all sorts of ways that we could imagine benefits coming directly back to the island if Pacific Islanders had better access to the high-value work that we see in Australia and New Zealand.
The governor of Papua New Guinea's West Septic, or Sedun province, is calling for the national government to help connect Vamuno's electric grid with neighboring Indonesia. Indonesia has linked up power from the capital of Papua province, Jayapura, to Watung at the border with PNG. But Amkip May is frustrated that the state-owned company PNG Power has stalled on connecting his province's capital to the grid to Watung. He told Johnny Blades, Vinumo must do this for its growing development needs.
The PNG government and the bureaucrats in Waigani think that Vanimo is still a small town. They don't understand that it has grown over the last 5 years or so into becoming a very big town. And that's why there is always shortage of power, and a lot of the houses built have not been been put by power. So what I have done is I've organized with the Indonesian side to bring the power across. But that's politics. That's politics. So PNG Power is not connecting the power. So I ordered a big generator, Caterpillar generator, from Jakarta at the cost of 1.2 million kina. And also I have put 3 million kina of my PSIT fund to bring the transmission line from Vanimo to Batas. That's the market, the Wutung board, so that we can connect the power from Indonesia. Because the capacity that we want now is, right now it's about 1.52 megawatts. We need another 3 megawatts of power.
That's for Vanimo Town or for your whole province?
No, that's for Vanimo Town and palm oil. You know, there's a big plantation in Dewani, palm oil. And there's a big cocoa plantation in Dewani as well. And they need power urgently.
So what you're doing is to try and get power for the big Dewani project development, also for the provincial capital?
Yes, as well as for the Wutung Trade Center, you know, where you've seen the buildings, you know. We are going to do trade with Indonesia. We need power there as well for the public servants and the workers out at the Batas or the Wutung border.
Currently, as it stands, the Indonesians have connected their electricity to Batas, but no further?
That's it. They have connected theirs from Indonesia to Batas, but the PNG power is too slow.
Why is that? Is that because PNG Power is short of money or...?
I don't think PNG Power is short of money. I think they don't have the bigger vision. We need to bring power to the oil farm, to Bata, so that PNG Power can actually make money from those plantations, from the houses, etc. But they're too slow, and for the connection, they are doubting because of border security reasons.
A couple of months ago in local media, you mentioned there were power poles already in Vanimo, but they haven't been put up.
That's correct. They put in power poles and power, you know, those power cables. They put it in Vanimo, and they never put it up. And I think there was some politics in it. People don't want me to succeed.
You've obviously spoken to the State Enterprises Ministry about this?
Yes, I spoke to him in Parliament, and he said that the agreement with Indonesia will continue. Now, that was about 2 months ago. And since then, I'm not seeing anything on the ground. So that's why I'm pushing myself to buy the generator, and I'm putting the PSIT fund to bring the power poles from Vanimo to the border.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Immigration to the United States from Marshall Island continues to soar. The lack of opportunity and high poverty levels are key factors driving the movement. A recent ADB assessment says over half of Marshall Islands' population live below the national poverty line. Marshall Islands and people from Palau and the Federation States of Micronesia have visa-free access to the United States through the Compact of Free Association, allowing them to live and work there indefinitely. Correspondent Marshall Griff Johnson told Don Wiseman that an estimated 40% of Marshall Islanders now live in the United States.
There are about 55,000 people here in the Marshall Islands and probably about approaching 40,000 in the U.S. Of course, there's a large population of Marshall Islanders in Hawaii, but possibly the largest settlement is in the northwest area of Arkansas. The estimates of the number of Marshallese living in Arkansas range from anywhere from 8 to 15,000, and it's a really significant population with a large number of people working in factories there. But significantly, Marshallese are being recruited by employers to work there because of the ease of employment and the lack of any requirement of work permits. So there's no issue, say, of hiring people who, you know, have to go through labor requirements and so on. There's now, I think, a couple thousand Marshallese students in the Springdale, Arkansas schools.
Do they form a community? Is it a tight community, that group in northwest Arkansas?
There are organizations representing people, and of course people tend to gather according to religions. At last count several years ago, I was told there were 27 Marshallese churches in that area, which also gives you an idea of how many people are over there. But Arkansas isn't the only focus of migration. There are significant populations in the west coast states of Oregon, Washington, and California. And interestingly, one of the early settlements way back before the Compact of Free Association offered visa-free access, so it wasn't so easy to go in. A group of Marshallese settled in the L.A. Orange County area, but that community never really blossomed any larger than maybe 500 or so people. But now Sacramento has now become a really large and growing population. So it's like a few people put down some roots, maybe buy a house, get set up, start working, and then tell the relatives, come on over. And we've even seen, not with Marshallese, but Micronesians from the Federated States of Micronesia. There's a little town in Minnesota, of all places, population 400 people or something, and now virtually half the town is made up of Micronesians. And they're now blending in, and people who are mostly Scandinavian, of Scandinavian descent, who settled the town, seem to be delighted to have the Micronesians there because they're kind of revitalizing the town with lots of kids. And I mean, just some very different type of situations that Micronesians and Marshallese are developing in the U.S.
One of the key drivers for all of this migration, of course, is disappearing job opportunities in the Marshall Islands. Is there any long-term prospect of that turning around?
An annual economic report issued last month by the Graduate School USA on the Marshall Islands shows that from 2004 to last year, there were only 220 or so jobs created in the private sector. That's like 15 or 16 jobs a year. Government expanded more, but it just shows you that there's just been a really finite job market here. And could more people be employed? Yes, there's lots of money coming in for infrastructure, so there are construction jobs and so on. But I think that an atoll has a limited number of things it can do to employ people. And right now there's almost 30,000 people in Majuro, which is really an unsustainable level of population, just like South Tarawa and in Kiribati. I mean, the size of these populations in the capital cities of these atolls is just huge. So unemployment is high. Interestingly, we have a fish processing plant here in Majuro, but they struggle to get workers because they're relatively low paid, I mean, around $2 an hour. And they used to get 400 people per day working on their fish processing lines. Now they're lucky if they can get 170 a day. And I think what it is a lot of Marshall Islanders just look to the U.S. If they want to go work in a factory, they'll go to Arkansas, where they'll start at one of the poultry packing plants, at $9 or $10 an hour. That's been an issue in terms of trying to get people employed here, is people don't want the job.
Are there significant remittances coming back from all of those communities in the U.S.?
We are now seeing it. I'd say 15 years ago, the feeling was that both in the Marshall Islands and the Federated States of Micronesia, remittances were not significant, not in the way that they have been for Kiribati and Tuvalu for many years. But in more recent times, yes, there's been a lot of money coming back. But interestingly, particularly at the U.S. tax refund time, which is in the February and March period, and then relatives in the U.S. send literally tens of thousands of dollars back home, and mostly it's used for people to get their passports and a one-way ticket to join their relatives in the U.S. So we see February, March, April period as a high time each year now for outbound Marshallese heading on one-way tickets to go up for a job or take their kids to get them into school or look for health care or whatever. But generally, jobs and education is really driving people to move to the U.S.
A Pacific Studies scholar says language weeks are a good way to break down high levels of intolerance of other languages being spoken in New Zealand. Fiji is the latest language to be celebrated around the country. Karori Hawkins reports.
The Sevu Sevu, or cover ceremony, at Victoria University of Wellington is a fitting start to a week of celebrating the Fijian language around New Zealand. There are around 150 Fijians studying at the university, the second largest Pacifica group after Samoans. The theme for Fijian Language Week this year is Nongu Vosa Meumbula Taka, my language, learn it, speak it, live it. The message is particularly apt for young Fijians studying, living and born in New Zealand. Of the three Fijian youths who took part in the Sevu Sevu, only one speaks Fijian fluently. However, Jamie Madavan, Colinio Bauer and Viliame Rawalai all agree that Fiji Language Week means something to them as young Fijians.
Yeah, I don't really speak any Fijian, but this is just a good, really good opportunity for people like myself to learn. And yeah, it's just nice that the country now is embracing the culture for the last, I think, 4 years.
And for me, born here in New Zealand, it's good to just catch up with all the Fijian community and just to socialise with them. And also partake in like the ceremony.
Yeah, I think it depends on the person, because I'm from Fiji originally, so like for me it's a way of connecting back to home.
Nearly 14,500 people in New Zealand identify as Fijian according to the 2013 census, and Fijians make up nearly 5% of the New Zealand Pacific population. But it was to young Fijians in particular that Pastor Sikeli Dawanikawai was speaking when he made this challenge.
How can we sing our language in this strange land? Or how do we maintain our language, our culture, our tradition in this strange land?
One answer to this challenge is research. The Director of Samoan and Pacific Studies at Victoria, Teresia Teaiwa, says there is a need for young Fijian academics to conduct studies into Fijian issues in their own language.
Because a lot of the time when people have developed scholarly expertise on Fiji, they've been very reliant on English sources and English texts. And that cuts out a whole multiplicity of sources that give you different perspectives on what's happened in the past and what's happening now in Fiji.
But Fijian postgraduate student Madhiu Vudango says possibly even more important than anything academic is simply encouraging Fijian families to speak to their children in Fijian at home.
I'm a father of three young kids, and the kids don't speak Fijian anymore. But they understand the instructions given to them in Fijian, but they just can't converse back, not in full sentences. It's not easy trying to protect and grow a foreign language from a New Zealand point of view.
Fijian student Motea Dawanikawai also says young Fijians need to speak their language outside their homes.
I don't think it's spoken enough, because I've seen the New Zealand-born Fijians here, and they understand, but they don't speak it as much. But I know that they're learning a lot, especially with this, when we have this on. They have workshops where they're actually to learn and just put into practice Fijian-speaking Fijian.
And another student, Salote Dama, says it's also important to speak Fijian consistently and in all contexts to avoid negative perceptions of the language.
Because sometimes languages are only spoken when someone's really angry, and so people associate the language with something negative. It's important to speak the language at home in all the contexts, in happiness, in sadness, in just everyday pass-the-bread conversations.
Teresia Te Aiwa says while New Zealand is way ahead of many Western countries in recognising the minority languages, there are still high levels of intolerance. She says this is particularly evident in the mangling of Maori and Pacific Island names in the media and the way this is accepted across the country.
It's an arrogance that says, I don't need to learn. And the bottom line is, if you're a real professional, you will try to get someone's name right. And if we do that for Europeans, why can't we extend the same courtesy to people who are of other heritages?
The Ministry for Pacific Peoples says Pacific Language Weeks have grown significantly since Samoan Language Week was first celebrated in 2007. Niuen and Tokelauan are to be celebrated in the next 2 weeks. This is Koroi Hawkins.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program or have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hello, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program again, as well as past editions, by visiting our website, www.pcjmedia.com. On the right side of the webpage, you'll find a link for Focus Asia Pacific and can subscribe to it via iTunes. Anyway, that's all we have time for. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Perron, wishing you well, saying so long, and take care.